stopped straining against the ropes when he saw the man approaching. He said and tugged against the ropes, restraining him.
Wash!
It was a question this time.
Hmm?
The old man looked around and saw me for the first time.
Oh, hello.
He looked back to the boy on the bed.
Well, aren't you the clever one today? Tani called me in to see we have a visitor.
Tani's face broke into a terrific grin, and he gave a harsh, honking gasp of breath. In spite of the painful sound, it was clear he was laughing. Turning to look at me, the barefoot man said,
I don't recognize you. Have you been here before?
I shook my head.
Well, I've got some bread, only 2 days old. If you carry some water for me, you can have as much as you can eat.
He looked at me.
Does that sound all right?
I nodded. A chair, table, and an open barrel standing near one of the doors were the only furnishings in the room aside from the cots. 4 large round loaves were stacked on the table. He nodded too, then began to move carefully towards the chair. He walked gingerly as if it pained him to set his feet down. After he reached the chair and sank into it, he pointed to the barrel by the doorway.
Through the door, there's a pump and bucket. Don't bother to hurry. It's not a race.
As he spoke, he absent-mindedly crossed his legs and began to rub one of his bare feet. Inefficient circulation, a long, unused part of me thought. Increased risk of infection and considerable discomfort. Feet and legs should be raised, massaged, and swabbed in a warm infusion of willow bark camphor and arrow root.
Don't fill the bucket too full. I don't want you to hurt yourself or spill all over. It's wet enough down here.
He eased his foot back to the floor and bent to gather up one of the tiny children who was beginning to stir restlessly on the blanket. As I filled the barrel, I snuck glances at the man. His hair was grey, but despite that and the slow, tender manner in which he walked, he wasn't very old, perhaps 40, probably a little less. He wore a long robe, patched and mended to such a degree that I couldn't really guess at its original colour or shape. Though nearly as ragged as I was, he was cleaner, which isn't to say that he was clean exactly, just cleaner than me. It wasn't hard to be. His name was Trappis. The patched robe was the only piece of clothing he owned. He spent nearly every moment of his waking life in that damp basement caring for the hopeless people no one else would bother with. Most of them were young boys. Some, like Tani, had to be restrained so they wouldn't hurt themselves or roll out of their beds. Others, like Jaspin, who had gone fever mad 2 years ago, had to be restrained so they wouldn't hurt others. Palsied, crippled, catatonic, spastic, Trappis tended them all with equal and unending patience. I never once heard him complain of anything, not even his bare feet, which were always swollen and must have pained him constantly. He gave us children what help he could, a bit of food when he had some to spare. To earn a little something to eat, we carried water, scrubbed his floor, ran errands, and held the babies so they wouldn't cry. We did whatever he asked, and when there wasn't any food, we could always have a drink of water, a tired smile, and someone who looked at us as if we were human, not animals in rags. Sometimes it seemed that Trappis alone was trying to care for all the hopeless creatures in our corner of Tarbin. In return, we loved him with a silent ferocity that only animals can match. If anyone had ever raised a hand to Trappis, 100 howling children would have torn them to bloody scraps in the middle of the street. I stopped by his basement often in those first few months, then less and less as time went by. Trappis and Tani were fine companions. None of us felt the need to talk much, and that suited me fine. But the other street children made me unspeakably nervous, so I visited infrequently, only when I was in desperate need of help, or when I had something to share. Despite the fact that I was seldom there, it was good to know there was one place in the city where I wouldn't be kicked at, chased, or spit on. It helped when I was out on the rooftops alone, knowing that Trappis and the basement were there. It was almost like a home you could come back to. Almost. Chapter 22. A Time for Demons. I learned many things those first months in Tarbin. I learned which inns and restaurants threw away the best food and how rotten food needed to be before it made you sick to eat it. I learned that the walled complex of buildings near the docks was the Temple of Teilu. The Teilins sometimes gave out bread, making us say prayers before we could take our loaf. I didn't mind. It was easier than begging. Sometimes the grey-robed priests tried to get me to come into the church to say the prayers, but I'd heard rumours and ran away whenever I was asked, whether I had my loaf or no. I learned how to hide. I had a secret place atop an old tannery where three roofs met, making a shelter from the wind and rain. Ben's book I secreted away under the rafters, wrapped in canvas. I handled it only rarely, like a holy relic. It was the last solid piece of my past, and I took every precaution to keep it safe. I learned that Tarbin is vast. You cannot understand if you have not seen it yourself. It is like the ocean. I can tell you of the waves and water, but you don't begin to get an inkling of its size until you stand on the shore. You don't really understand the ocean until you are in the midst of it. Nothing but ocean on all sides, stretching away endlessly. Only then do you realize how small you are, how powerless. Part of Tarbin's vastness is the fact that it is divided into a thousand small pieces, each with its own personality. There was Downing's, Drover Court, The Wash, Middletown, Tallows, Tunning, Dockside, the Tarway, Seamling Lane. You could live your whole life in Tarbin and never know all its parts. But for most practical purposes, Tarbin had two pieces, Waterside and Hillside. Waterside is where people are poor. That makes them beggars, thieves, and whores. Hillside is where people are rich. That makes them solicitors, politicians, and courtesans. I had been in Tarbin for 2 months when I first thought to try my hand at begging Hillside. Winter gripped the city firmly, and the midwinter pageantry was making the streets more dangerous than usual. This was shocking to me. Every winter, for the entirety of my young life, our troop had organized the midwinter pageantry for some town. Dressed in demon masks, we would terrorize them for the 7 days of high mourning, much to everyone's delight. My father played an Encanis, so convincing you'd think we'd conjured him. Most importantly, he could be frightening and careful at the same time. No one was ever hurt when our troop was in charge. But in Tarbin, it was different. Oh, the pieces of the pageantry were all the same. There were still men in garishly painted demon masks skulking about the city making mischief. Encanis was out there too, in the traditional black mask, making more serious trouble. And though I hadn't seen him, I didn't doubt silver-masked Teilu was striding around the better neighborhoods, playing his part. As I said, the pieces of the pageantry were the same. But they played out differently. For one thing, Tarbin was too big for one troop to provide enough demons. 100 troops wouldn't be enough, so rather than pay for professionals, as would be sensible and safe, the churches in Tarbin took the more profitable path of selling demon masks. Because of this, on the first day of high mourning, 10,000 demons were set loose on the city. 10,000 amateur demons with license to make whatever mischief they had minds to. This might seem like an ideal situation for a young thief to take advantage of, but really the opposite was true. The demons were always thickest waterside, and while the great majority behaved properly, fleeing at the sound of Teilu's name and keeping their devilry within reasonable bounds, many did not. Things were dangerous the first few days of high mourning, and I spent most of my time simply staying out of harm's way. But as midwinter approached, things settled down. The number of demons steadily decreased as people lost their masks or tired of the game. Telu no doubt eliminated his share as well, but Silver Mask or no, he was only one man. He could hardly cover the whole of Tarbin in just 7 days' time. I chose the last day of mourning for my trip hillside. Spirits are always high on Midwinter's Day, and high spirits mean good begging. Best of all, the ranks of the demons were noticeably thinned, which meant it was reasonably safe to be walking the streets again. I set out in the early afternoon, hungry because I couldn't find any bread to steal. I remember feeling vaguely excited as I headed towards Hillside. Maybe some part of me remembered what Midwinter had been like with my family. Warm meals and warm beds afterward. Maybe I'd been infected by the smell of evergreen boughs being gathered into piles and set ablaze in celebration of Telu's triumph. That day I learned two things. I learned why beggars stay waterside, and I learned that no matter what the church might tell you, Midwinter is a time for demons. I emerged from an alley and was instantly struck by the difference in atmosphere between this part of the city and where I had come from. Waterside, merchants wheedled and cajoled customers, hoping to lure them into their shops. Should that fail, they were not shy about bursting into fits of bellicosity, cursing, or even openly bullying customers. Here, the shop owners wrung their hands nervously. They bowed and scraped and were unfailingly polite. Voices were never raised. After the brutal reality of things waterside, it seemed to me as if I had stumbled into a formal ball. Everyone was dressed in new clothes, everyone was clean, and they all seemed to be participating in some sort of intricate social dance. But there were shadows here, too. As I surveyed the street, I spotted a pair of men lurking in the alleyway across from me. Their masks were quite good, blood red and fierce. One had a gaping mouth and the other a grimace of pointed white teeth. They were both wearing the traditional black hooded robes which I approved of. So many of the demons' waterside didn't bother with the proper costume. The pair of demons slipped out to follow a well-dressed young couple who were strolling idly down the street arm in arm. The demons stalked them carefully for nearly 100 feet. Then one of them snatched the gentleman's hat and thrust it into a nearby snowdrift. The other grabbed the woman in a rough embrace and lifted her from the ground. She shrieked while the man struggled with the demon for possession of his walking stick, obviously flummoxed by the situation. Luckily, his lady maintained her composure.
"Teos! Teos!" she shouted. "Teos Antausa Ea!"
At the sound of Telu's name, the two red-masked figures cowered, then turned and ran off down the street. Everyone cheered. One of the shopkeepers helped the gentleman retrieve his hat. I was rather surprised by the civility of it all. Apparently, even the demons were polite on the good side of town. Emboldened by what I had seen, I eyed the crowd, looking for my best prospects. I stepped up to a young woman. She wore a powder blue dress and had a wrap of white fur. Her hair was long and golden, curled artfully around her face. As I stepped forward, she looked down at me and stopped. I heard a startled intake of breath as one hand went to her mouth.
"Pennies, ma'am?"
I held out my hand and made it tremble just a little. My voice trembled too.
"Please?"
I tried to look every bit as small and hopeless as I felt. I shuffled from foot to foot in the thin grey snow.
"Poor dear,"
she sighed almost too quietly for me to hear. She fumbled with the purse at her side, either unable or unwilling to take her eyes from me. After a moment she looked inside her purse and brought something out. As she curled my fingers around it, I felt the cold, reassuring weight of a coin.
"Thank you, ma'am,"
I said automatically. I looked down for a moment and saw silver glinting through my fingers. I opened my hand and saw a silver penny. A whole silver penny. I gaped. A silver penny was worth 10 copper pennies or 50 iron ones, More than that, it was worth a full belly every night for half a month. For an iron penny, I could sleep on the floor at the Red Eye for the night. For two, I could sleep on the hearth by the embers of the evening fire. I could buy a rag blanket that I would hide on the rooftops, keeping me warm all winter. I looked up at the woman who was still looking down at me with pitying eyes. She couldn't know what this meant.
Lady, thank you.
My voice cracked. I remembered one of the things that we said back when I lived in the troop.
May all your stories be glad ones, and your roads be smooth and short.
She smiled at me, and might have said something, but I got a strange feeling near the base of my neck. Someone was watching me. On the street, you either develop a sensitivity to certain things, or your life is miserable and short. I looked around and saw a shopkeeper talking with a guard and gesturing in my direction. This wasn't some waterside guard. He was clean-shaven and upright. He wore a black leather jerkin with metal studs and carried a brass-bound club as long as his arm. I caught scraps of what the shopkeeper was saying.
Customers, who's going to buy chocolate with?
He gestured my way again and said something I couldn't catch.
Pays you? That's right. Maybe I should mention.
The guard turned his head to look in my direction. I caught his eyes. I turned and ran. I headed for the first alley I saw, my thin shoes slipping on the light layer of snow that covered the ground. I heard his heavy boots pounding behind me as I turned into a second alley, branching off from the first. My breath was burning in my chest as I looked for somewhere to go, somewhere to hide. But I didn't know this part of the city. There were no piles of trash to worm into, no burned-out buildings to climb through. I felt sharp, frozen gravel slice through the thin sole of one of my shoes. Pain tore through my foot as I forced myself to keep running. I ran into a dead end after my third turning. I was halfway up one of the walls when I felt a hand close around my ankle and pull me to the ground. My head hit the cobblestones, and the world spun dizzily as the guard lifted me off the ground, holding me by one wrist and my hair.
Clever boy, aren't you?
He panted, his breath hot on my face. He smelled like leather and sweat.
You're old enough. You should know not to run by now.
He shook me angrily and twisted my hair. I cried out as the alley tilted around me. He pressed me roughly against a wall.
You should know enough not to be coming hillside either,
he shook me. You dumb boy.
No,
I said muzzily as I felt for the cool wall with my free hand.
No.
My answer seemed to infuriate him.
No,
he bit off the word.
You got me in trouble, boy. I might get written up. If you aren't dumb, then you must need a lesson.
He spun me around and threw me down. I slid in the greasy alley snow. My elbow struck the ground and my arm went numb. The hand clutching a month of food, warm blankets and dry shoes came open. Something precious flew away and landed without even a clink as it hit the ground. I hardly noticed. The air hummed before his club cracked against my leg. He snarled at me.
Don't come hillside, understand?
The club caught me again, this time across the shoulder blades.
Everything past Fallow Street is off limits to you, little whore's sons, understand?
He backhanded me across the face, and I tasted blood as my head careened off the snow-covered cobbles. I curled into a ball as he hissed down at me.
And Mill Street and Mill Market is where I work, so you never come back here again!
He punctuated each word with a blow from his stick.
Understand?
I lay there shaking in the churned-up snow, hoping it was over, hoping he would just go away.
Understand?
He kicked me in the stomach, and I felt something tear inside of me. I cried out and must have babbled something. He kicked me again when I didn't get up, then went away. I think I passed out or lay in a daze. When I finally came to my senses again, it was dusk. I was cold to the very center of my bones. I crawled around in the muddy snow and wet garbage, searching for the silver penny with fingers so numb with cold they would barely work. One of my eyes was swelled shut, and I could taste blood, but I searched until the last scrap of evening's light was gone. Even after the alley had gone black as tar, I kept sifting the snow with my hands. though I knew in my heart of hearts that my fingers were too numb to feel the coin, even if I chanced to cross it. I used the wall to get to my feet and started to walk. My wounded foot made progress slow. Pain stabbed up my leg with each step, and I tried to use the wall as a crutch to keep some weight off it. I moved into Waterside, the part of the city that was more a home to me than anywhere else. My foot grew numb and wooden from the cold, and while that worried some rational piece of me, my practical side was just glad there was one less part of me that hurt. It was miles back to my secret place, and my limping progress was slow. At some point I must have fallen. I don't remember it, but I do remember lying in the snow and realizing how delightfully comfortable it was. I felt sleep drawing itself over me, like a thick blanket, like death. I closed my eyes. I remember the deep silence of the deserted street around me. I was too numb and tired to be properly afraid. In my delirium, I imagined death in the form of a great bird with wings of fire and shadow. It hovered above, watching patiently, waiting for me. I slept, and the great bird settled its burning wings around me. I imagined a delicious warmth. Then its claws were in me, tearing me open. No, it was just the pain of my torn ribs as someone rolled me onto my back. Blearily, I opened an eye and saw a demon standing over me. In my confused and credulous state, the sight of the man in the demon mask startled me into wakefulness. The seductive warmth I had felt a moment ago vanished, leaving my body limp and leaden.
"It is. I told you, there's a kid lying in the snow here."
The demon lifted me to my feet. Now awake, I noticed his mask was sheer black. This was Encanis, Lord of Demons. He set me unsteadily onto my feet and began to brush away the snow that covered me. Through my good eye, I saw a figure in a livid green mask standing nearby.
"Come on,"
the other demon said urgently, her voice sounding hollowly from behind the rows of pointed teeth. And Canis ignored her.
"Are you okay?"
I couldn't think of a response, so I concentrated on keeping my balance as the man continued to brush the snow away with the sleeve of his dark robe. I heard the sound of distant horns. The other demon looked nervously down the road.
"If we don't keep ahead of them, we'll be up to our shins in it,"
she hissed nervously. And Canis brushed the snow out of my hair with his dark gloved fingers, then paused and leaned in closer to look at my face. His dark mask loomed oddly in my blurry vision.
"God's body, Holly, someone's beaten the hell out of this kid. On Midwinter's Day, too."
"God,"
I managed to croak. I tasted blood when I said the word.
"You're freezing,"
Encanis said, and began to chafe my arms and legs with his hands, trying to get my blood flowing again.
"You'll have to come with us."
The horns sounded again, closer. They were mixed with the dim sounds of a crowd.
"Don't be stupid,"
the other demon said.
"He's in no shape to go running through the city."
"He's in no shape to stay here,"
Encanis snapped. He continued to massage my arms and legs roughly. Some feeling was slowly returning to them, mostly a stinging, prickly heat that was like a painful mockery of the soothing warmth I had felt a minute ago when I was drifting off to sleep. Pain jabbed at me each time he went over a bruise, but my body was too tired to flinch away. The green-masked demon came close and laid a hand on her friend's shoulder.
"We have to go now, Garrick. Someone else will take care of him."
She tried to pull her friend away and met with no success.
"If they find us here with him, they'll assume we did it."
The man behind the black mask swore, then nodded, and began to rummage around underneath his robe.
"Don't lie down again," he said to me in urgent tones, "and get inside, somewhere you can warm up."
The crowd sounds were close enough for me to hear individual voices mixed with the noise of horses' hooves and creaking wooden wheels. The man in the black mask held out his hand. It took me a moment to focus on what he held. A silver talent, thicker and heavier than the penny I had lost. So much money I could hardly think of it.
Go on, take it.
He was a form of darkness. Black hooded cloak, black mask, black gloves. Encanis stood in front of me, holding out a bright bit of silver that caught the moonlight. I was reminded of the scene from Deonica, where Tarsus sells his soul. I took the talent, but my hand was so numb I couldn't feel it. I had to look down to make sure my fingers were gripping it. I imagined I could feel warmth radiating up my arm. I felt stronger. I grinned at the man in the black mask.
Take my gloves too.
He pulled them off and pushed them against my chest. Then the woman in the green demon mask pulled my benefactor away before I could give him any word of thanks. I watched the two of them go. Their dark robes made them look like pieces of retreating shadow against the charcoal colors of Tarbin's moonlit streets. Not even a minute passed before I saw the pageantry's torchlight come around the corner towards me. The voices of 100 men and women singing and shouting crashed over me like waves. I moved away until I felt my back press up against a wall. Then I slid weakly sideways until I found a recessed doorway. I watched the pageantry from my vantage there. People poured by, shouting and laughing. Telu stood tall and proud in the back of a wagon drawn by 4 white horses. His silver mask gleamed in the torchlight. His white robes were immaculate and lined with fur at the cuff and collar. Grey-robed priests followed along beside the wagon, ringing bells and chanting. Many of them wore the heavy iron chains of penitent priests. The sound of the voices and the bells, the chanting and the chains, mingled to make a sort of music. All eyes were for Telu. No one saw me standing in the shadows of the doorway. It took nearly 10 minutes for all of them to pass. Only then did I emerge and begin to make my careful way home. It was slow going, but I felt fortified by the coin I held. I checked the talent every 12 steps or so to reassure myself that my numb hand was still gripping it tightly. I wanted to put on the gloves I had been given, but I feared to drop the coin and lose it in the snow. I don't know how long it took for me to get back. The walking warmed me slightly, though my feet still felt wooden and numb. When I looked back over my shoulder, my trail was marked by a smear of blood in every other footprint. It reassured me in an odd way. A foot that bleeds is better than one that is frozen solid. I stopped at the first inn I recognized, the Laughing Man. It was full of music, singing, and celebration. I avoided the front door and went around to the back alley. There were a pair of young girls chatting in the kitchen doorway, avoiding their work. I limped up to them, using the wall as a crutch. They didn't notice me until I was nearly on top of them. The younger one looked up at me and gasped. I took a step closer.
Could one of you bring me food and a blanket? I can pay.
I held out my hand and was frightened by how much it shook. It was smeared with blood from when I had touched the side of my face. The inside of my mouth felt raw. It hurt to talk.
Please.
They looked at me for a moment in stunned silence. Then they looked at each other, and the older of the two motioned the other inside. The young girl disappeared through the door without a word. The older girl, who might have been 16, came closer to me and held out her hand. I gave her the coin and let my arm fall heavily to my side. She looked at it and disappeared inside after a second long glance at me. Through the open doorway, I heard the warm, bustling sounds of a busy inn, the low murmur of conversation punctuated with laughter, the bright clink of bottle glass and the dull thump of wooden tankards on tabletops. And threading gently through it all, a lute played in the background. It was faint, almost drowned by the other noise, but I heard it the same way a mother can mark her child crying from 12 rooms away. The music was like a memory of family, of friendship and warm belonging, It made my gut twist and my teeth ache. For a moment my hands stopped aching from the cold and instead longed for the familiar feel of music running through them. I took a slow, shuffling step, slowly sliding along the wall. I moved back away from the doorway until I couldn't hear the music anymore. Then I took another step, until my hands hurt with the cold again, and the ache in my chest came from nothing more than broken ribs. They were simpler pains, easier to endure. I don't know how long it was before the two girls came back. The younger one held out a blanket wrapped around something. I hugged it to my aching chest. It seemed disproportionately heavy for its size, but my arms were trembling slightly under their own weight, so it was hard to tell. The older girl held out a small, solid purse. I took it as well, clutching it so tightly my frost-burned fingers ached. She looked at me.
You can have a corner by the fire in here if you want it.
The younger girl nodded quickly.
Natty won't mind.
She took a step and reached out to take my arm. I jerked away from her, almost falling.
No.
I meant to shout, but it came out as a weak croak.
Don't touch me.
My voice was shaking, though I couldn't tell if I was angry or afraid. I staggered away against the wall. My voice was blurry in my ears.
I'll be fine.
The younger girl started to cry, her hands hanging useless at her sides.
I've got somewhere to go.
My voice cracked, and I turned away. I hurried off as fast as I could. I wasn't sure what I was running from, unless it was people. That was another lesson I had learned perhaps too well. People meant pain. I heard a few muffled sobs behind me. It seemed a long while before I made it to the corner. I made it to my hidden place, where the roofs of two buildings met underneath the overhang of a third. I don't know how I managed to climb up there. Inside the blanket was a whole flask of spiced wine and a loaf of fresh bread nestled next to a turkey breast bigger than both my bald fists. I wrapped myself in the blanket and moved out of the wind as the snow turned to sleet. The brick of the chimney behind me was warm and wonderful. The first swallow of wine burned my mouth like fire where it was cut, but the second didn't sting nearly so much. The bread was soft, and the turkey was still warm. I woke at midnight when all the bells in the city started ringing. People ran and shouted in the streets. The 7 days of high mourning were behind us. Midwinter was past. A new year had begun. Chapter 23. The Burning Wheel. I stayed tucked into my secret place all that night, and woke late the next day to find my body had stiffened into a tight knot of pain. Since I still had food and a little wine, I stayed where I was rather than risk falling when I tried to climb down to the street. It was a sunless day with a damp wind that never seemed to stop. Sleet gusted under the protection of the overhanging roof. The chimney was warm behind me, but it wasn't enough to actually dry out my blanket or drive away the chilly damp that soaked my clothes. I finished the wine and the bread early on, and after that I spent most of my time gnawing at the turkey bones and trying to warm up snow in the empty wine flask so I could drink it. Neither proved very productive, and I ended up eating mouthfuls of slushy snow that left me shivering with the taste of tar in my mouth. Despite my injuries, I dropped off to sleep in the afternoon and woke late at night filled with the most wonderful warmth. I pushed away my blanket and rolled away from the now too hot chimney, only to wake near dawn, shivering and soaked through to the skin. I felt strange, dizzy and fuddled. I huddled back against the chimney and spent the rest of the day drifting in and out of a restless, fevered sleep. I have no memory of how I made it off the rooftop, delirious with fever and nearly crippled. I don't remember making my way the 3/4 of a mile through Tallows and the crates. I only remember falling down the stairs that led to Trappis's basement, my purse of money clutched tight in my hand. As I lay there shivering and sweating, I heard the faint slapping of his bare feet on the stone.
"What, what?"
he said gently as he picked me up.
"Hush, hush."
Trappis nursed me through the long days of my fever. He wrapped me in blankets, fed me, and when my fever showed no signs of breaking on its own, he used the money I'd brought to buy a bittersweet medicine. He kept my face and hands wet and cool while murmuring his patient, gentle,
"What, what? Hush, hush,"
while I cried out from endless fever dreams of my dead parents, the Chandrian, and a man with empty eyes. I woke clear-headed and cool. Tanny said loudly from where he was tied to his cot.
"What, what? Hush, hush, Tanny,"
Trappis said as he put down one of the babies and picked up the other. It looked around owlishly with wide, dark eyes, but seemed unable to support its own head. It was quiet in the room. Tanny said again. I coughed, trying to clear my throat.
"There's a cup on the floor next to you,"
Trappis said, brushing a hand along the head of the baby he held. Tanny bellowed, strange half-gasps punctuating his cry. The noise agitated several of the others, who moved restlessly in their cots. The older boy, sitting in the corner, raised his hands to the sides of his head and began to moan. He started rocking back and forth, gently at first, but then more and more violently, so that when he came forward, his head knocked against the bare stone of the wall. Trappis was at his side before the boy could do himself any real harm. He put his arms around the rocking boy.
"Hush, hush, Loni, hush, hush."
The boy's rocking slowed, but did not entirely subside.
"Tanny, you know better than to make all that noise."
His voice was serious, but not stern.
"Why are you making trouble? Loni could hurt himself."
Tanny said softly. I thought I could detect a note of remorse in his voice.
"I think he wants a story,"
I said, surprising myself by speaking.
"Ah,"
Tanny said.
"Is that what you want, Tanny?"
There was a quiet moment.
"I don't know any stories," he said.
Tanny remained stubbornly silent. Everyone knows one story, I thought. Everyone knows at least one. Trappis looked around at the quiet room, as if looking for an excuse.
"Well," he said reluctantly, "it has been a while since we had a story, hasn't it?"
He looked down at the boy in his arms.
"Would you like a story, Loni?"
Loni nodded a violent affirmation, nearly battering Trappis's cheek with the back of his head.
"Will you be good and sit by yourself so I can tell a story?"
Loni stopped rocking almost immediately. Trappis slowly unwrapped his arms and stepped away. After a long look to make sure the boy wouldn't hurt himself, he stepped carefully back to his chair.
"Well,"
he muttered softly to himself as he stooped to pick up the baby he had set aside.
"Do I have a story?"
He spoke very quietly to the child's wide eyes.
"No, no, I don't. Can I remember one? I suppose I had better."
He sat for a long moment, humming to the child in his arms, a thoughtful expression on his face.
"Yes, of course."
He sat up taller in his chair.
"Are you ready? This is a story from long ago, back before any of us were born. before our fathers were born, too. It was a long time ago. Maybe 400 years. No more than that. Probably 1,000 years, but maybe not quite as much as that. It was a bad time in the world. People were hungry and sick. There were famines and great plagues. There were many wars and other bad things in this time, because there was no one to stop them. But the worst thing in this time was that there were demons walking the land. Some of them were small and troublesome creatures who lamed horses and spoiled milk, but there were many worse than those. There were demons who hid in men's bodies and made them sick or mad. But those were not the worst. There were demons like great beasts that would catch and eat men while they were still alive and screaming. But they were not the worst. Some demons stole the skins of men and wore them like clothes, but even they were not the worst. There was one demon who stood above the others, Encarnis, the swallowing darkness. No matter where he walked, shadows hid his face, and scorpions that stung him died of the corruption they had touched. Now, Telu, who made the world, and who is lord over all, watched the world of men. He saw that demons made sport of us, and killed us, and ate our bodies. Some men he saved, but only a few. For Telu is just, and saves only the worthy. And in these times few men acted even for their own good, let alone the good of others. Because of this, Telu was unhappy, for he had made the world to be a good place for men to live. But his church was corrupt. They stole from the poor and did not live by the laws he had given. No, wait, there was no church yet and no priests either, just men and women, and some of them knew who Telu was. But even those were wicked, so when they called on Lord Telu for help, he felt no desire to aid them. But after years of watching and waiting, Telu saw a woman pure of heart and spirit. Her name was Periel. Her mother had raised her to know Telu, and she worshipped him as well as her poor circumstances allowed. Although her own life was hard, Periel prayed only for others and never for herself. Telu watched her for long years. He saw her life was hard, full of misfortune and torment at the hands of demons and bad men. But she never cursed his name or ceased her praying, and she never treated any person other than with kindness and respect. So, late one night, Telu went to her in a dream. He stood before her and seemed to be made entirely of fire or sunlight. He came to her in splendour and asked her if she knew who he was. Sure enough, she said. You see, she was very calm about it because she thought she was just having an odd dream. Your Lord Telu. He nodded and asked her if she knew why he had come to her. Are you going to do something for my neighbour, Deborah? She asked, because that's who she had prayed for before she went to sleep. Are you going to lay your hand on her husband, Lozel, and make him a better man? The way he treats her isn't right. Man should never lay a hand on woman, save in love. Telu knew her neighbours. He knew they were wicked people who had done wicked things. Everyone in the village was wicked but her. Everyone in the world was. He told her so. Deborah has been very kind and good to me, Periel said, and even Lozel, who I don't care for, is one of my neighbours all the same. Telu told her that Deborah spent time in many different men's beds, and Lozel drank every day of the week, even on morning. No, wait, there wasn't any morning yet, but he drank a lot at any rate. Sometimes he grew so angry that he beat his wife until she could not stand or even cry aloud.
Periel was quiet for a long moment in her dream. She knew Telu spoke the truth. But while Periel was pure of heart, she was not a fool. She had suspected her neighbors of doing the things Telu said. Even now that she knew for certain, she cared for her neighbors all the same.
You want help her?
Telu said that the man and wife were each other's fitting punishment. They were wicked, and the wicked should be punished. Periel spoke out honestly, perhaps because she thought she was dreaming, but perhaps she would have said the same thing had she been awake. But Periel said what was in her heart. It's not their fault that the world is full of hard choices and hunger and loneliness, she said. What can you expect of people when demons are their neighbors? But though Telu listened to her wise words with his ears, he told her that mankind was wicked, and the wicked should be punished. I think you know very little about what it is to be a man, she said, and I would still help them if I could, she told him resolutely. So you shall, Telu told her, and reached out to lay his hand on her heart. When he touched her, she felt like she were a great golden bell that had just rung out its first note. She opened her eyes and knew then that it had been no normal dream. Thus it was that she was not surprised to discover she was pregnant. In 3 months, she gave birth to a perfect dark-eyed baby boy. She named him Menda. The day after he was born, Menda could crawl. In 2 days he could walk. Periel was surprised but not worried, for she knew the child was a gift from God. Nevertheless, Periel was wise. She knew that people might not understand, so she kept Menda close by her, and when her friends and neighbors came to visit, she sent them away. But this could only last a little while, for in a small town there are no secrets. Folk knew that Periel was not married, and while children born out of wedlock were common during this time, children who grew to manhood in less than 2 months were not. They were afraid that she might have lain down with a demon, and that her child was a demon's child. Such things were not unheard of in those dark times, and the people were afraid. So everyone gathered together on the first day of the seventh span and made their way to the tiny house where Periel lived by herself with her son. The town smith, whose name was Rengen, led them. "Show us the boy," he yelled. But there was no response from the house. "Bring out the boy and show us he is nothing but a human child." The house remained quiet. And though there were many men among them, no one wanted to enter a house that might have a demon's child inside. So the smith cried out again, "Periel, bring out young Menda, or we will burn your house around you." The door opened, and a man stepped out. None of them recognized who it was, because even though he was only 7 span from the womb, Menda looked to be a young man of 17. He stood proud and tall, with coal black hair and eyes. "I am the one you think is Menda," he said in a voice both powerful and deep. "What do you want of me?" The sound of his voice made Periel gasp inside the cottage. Not only was this the first time Menda had ever spoken, but she recognized his voice as the same one that had spoken to her in a dream months ago.
"What do you mean, we think you are Menda?" asked the smith, gripping his hammer tightly. He knew that there were demons that looked like men, or wore their skins like costumes, the way a man might hide beneath a sheepskin. The child who was not a child spoke again. "I am Periel's son, but I am not Menda, and I am not a demon." "Touch the iron of my hammer, then," said Rengen, for he knew all demons feared 2 things, cold iron and clean fire. He held out his heavy forge hammer. It shook in his hands, but no one thought the less of him for it. He who was not Mender stepped forward and lay both hands on the iron head of the hammer. Nothing happened. From the doorway of her house where she watched, Periel burst into tears, for though she trusted Teilu, some part of her had held a mother's worry for her son. "I am not Mender, though that is what my mother called me. I am Teilu, lord above all. I have come to free you from demons and the wickedness of your own hearts. I am Teilu, son of myself. Let the wicked hear my voice and tremble." And they did tremble. But some of them refused to believe. They called him a demon and threatened him. They spoke hard, frightened words. Some threw stones and cursed him and spat toward him and his mother. Then Teilu grew angry, and he might have slain them all. But Periel leaped forward and laid a restraining hand on his shoulder. "What more can you expect," she asked him quietly, "from men who live with demons for their neighbors? Even the best dog will bite that has been kicked enough." Teilu considered her words and saw that she was wise. So he looked over his hands at Rengen, looked deep into his heart and said, "Rengen, son of Engen, you have a mistress who you pay to lie with you. Some men come to you for work, and you cheat or steal from them. And though you pray loudly, you do not believe. I, Teilu, made the world and watch over all who live here." When Rengen heard this, he grew pale and dropped his hammer to the ground. For what Teilu said to him was true. Teilu looked at all the men and women there. He looked into their hearts and spoke of what he saw. All of them were wicked, so much that Rengen was among the best of them. Then Teilu drew a line in the dirt of the road, so that it lay between himself and all those who had come. "This road is like the meandering course of a life. There are two paths to take, side by side. Each of you are already travelling that side. You must choose. Stay on your own path, or cross to mine."
"But the road is the same, isn't it? It still goes to the same place," someone asked.
"Yes.
Where does the road lead?"
"Death. All lives end in death excepting one. Such is the way of things."
"And what does it matter which side a man is on?"
It was Rengen asking these questions. He was a large man, one of the few that was taller than dark-eyed Teilu. But he was shaken by all that he had seen and heard in the past few hours.
"What is on our side of the road?"
"Pain," Teilu said in a voice as hard and cold as stone. "Punishment."
"And your side?"
"Pain now," Teilu said in the same voice. "Punishment now for all that you have done. It cannot be avoided. But I am here too. This is my path."
"How do I cross?"
"Regret, repent, and cross to me."
Rengen stepped over the line to stand beside his god. Then Teilu bent to pick up the hammer that the smith had dropped. But instead of giving it back, he struck Rengen with it as if it were a lash. Once, twice, thrice, and the third blow sent Rengen to his knees, sobbing and crying out in pain. But after the third blow, Teilu laid the hammer aside and knelt to look Rengen in the face. "You were the first to cross," he said softly, so only the smith could hear. "It was a brave thing, a hard thing to do. I am proud of you. You are no longer Rengen. Now you are Wereth, the forger of the path." Then Teilu embraced him with both arms, and his touch took much of the pain from Rengen, who was now Wereth. But not all, for Teilu spoke truly when he said that punishment cannot be avoided. One by one they crossed,
and one by one Teilu struck them down with the hammer. But after each man or woman fell, Teilu knelt and spoke to them, giving them new names and healing some of their hurt. Many of the men and women had demons hiding inside them that fled screaming when the hammer touched them. These people Teilu spoke with a while longer, but he always embraced them in the end, and they were all grateful. Some of them danced for the joy of being free of such terrible things living inside them. In the end, seven stayed on the other side of the line. Teilu asked them 3 times if they would cross, and 3 times they refused. After the 3rd asking, Teilu sprang across the line, and he struck each of them a great blow, driving them to the ground. But not all were men. When Teilu struck the 4th, there was the sound of quenching iron and a smell of burning leather, for the 4th man had not been a man at all, but a demon wearing a man's skin. When it was revealed, Teilu grabbed the demon and broke it in his hands, cursing its name and sending it back to the outer darkness that is the home of its kind. The remaining 3 let themselves be struck down. None of them were demons, though demons fled the bodies of some who fell. After he was done, Teilu did not speak to the 6 who did not cross, nor did he kneel to embrace them and ease their wounds. The next day, Teilu set off to finish what he had begun. He walked from town to town, offering each village he met the same choice he had given before. Always the results were the same. Some crossed, some stayed, some were not men at all, but demons, and those he destroyed. But there was one demon who eluded Teilu. Incanis, whose face was all in shadow. Incanis, whose voice was like a knife in the minds of men. Wherever Teilu stopped to offer men the choice of path, Incanis had been there just before, killing crops and poisoning wells. Incanis setting men to murder one another and stealing children from their beds at night. At the end of 7 years, Teilu's feet had carried him all through the world. He had driven out the demons that plagued us, all but one. Incanis ran free and did the work of 1,000 demons, destroying and despoiling wherever he went. So Teilu chased, and Incanis fled. Soon Teilu was a span of days behind the demon, then 2 days, then 1/2 day. Finally he was so close, he felt the chill of Incanis's passing, and could spy places where he had set his hands and feet, for they were marked with a cold black frost. Knowing he was pursued, Incanis came to a great city. The Lord of Demons called forth his power, and the city was brought to ruin. He did this, hoping Teilu would delay so he could make his escape, but the walking god paused only to appoint priests who cared for the people of the ruined town. For 6 days, Incanis fled, and 6 great cities he destroyed. But on the 7th day, Teilu drew near before Incanis could bring his power to bear, and the 7th city was saved. That is why 7 is a lucky number, and why we celebrate on Canaan. Incanis was now hard-pressed and bent his whole thought upon escape. But on the 8th day, Teilu did not pause to sleep or eat, and thus it was that at the end of felling, Teilu caught Incanis. He leaped on the demon and struck him with his forge hammer. Incanis fell like a stone, but Teilu's hammer shattered and lay in the dust of the road. Teilu carried the demon's limp body all through the long night, and on the morning of the 9th day he came to the city of Artur. When men saw Teilu carrying the demon's senseless form, they thought Incanis dead, But Taelu knew that such a thing was not easily done.